Well, good afternoon, everybody. My name is George, and I am an alcoholic. My home group is the Unity Service and Recovery Group of Northridge. It is the best men's stag meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous. Yeah. And, if you don't think your home group is the best group in AA, then you might not be in the right one. Who knows, folks? And I'm also privileged to be the... They can't hear me? No. I'm also privileged to be the archivist for Central California Area 93. What an honor that is. I'd like to ask for a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the last 75 years, please. Boy, what an honor and a privilege it is to be asked to be chairman of this thing. It was pretty awesome. I'm going to introduce our speakers right now. And our first speaker, I believe we're going to have, is Sarah. Okay.
Sorry about that. I thought I was going to be the last speaker, and I was like, oh, great. Oh, well. My name is Sarah. Sarah D. Hi. Hi, everybody. It's a great pleasure to be here. My sobriety date is December 29th, 1991, and for that I am eternally grateful. I've made some notes. I'm not one of those spontaneous speakers. So if you see my eyes shifting to these pages, it's just so that I don't stand here grinning at you. Just to give you a short history of our experience in Southeast Texas area, it wasn't until July 1986 that we approved the establishment of an archives committee. So we got a late start, and that has posed certain problems. Our area service became active in the 60s. We've got a period of time there that it seems like we're missing records. I know that there are old-timers out there with records under their bed, but we haven't been able to smoke them out yet. In the beginning of 1988, our first archivist reported the collection would have its repository at the Houston Intergroup, which I understand is not uncommon. We have this at the space for a nominal annual rate, actually $25 a year. I don't think you can beat that. By July 1992, we had had two archivists. When the second one resigned, there was some discussion about having a permanent archivist serve the area. Apparently, at that point, there were other areas who had a permanent archivist. And we were having a little trouble keeping track of the two that we had had, and there were some other issues I'm not going to go into. October, the position of permanent archivist was approved, and the archivist was elected. And just as a personal aside, I had just started service work. It was my first assembly, and I happened to be sitting next to the lady who became the first permanent archivist. I became this archivist in 1992, and the second permanent archivist. She resigned and moved to San Antonio. What it was like. Though the intergroup offered to give the area space to rent at a nominal rate, there was an issue with losing material because of rotation. The minutes state simply that there was some discussion about the establishment of a permanent archivist. From what I understand, and I was too new to really remember much of what was going on, there was what they call, quote unquote, some discussion. I'm sure it was lively, about the position. But they did decide that for the sake of continuity, that was what they would do. the archives and see it has undergone changes through the years. Our original goal, according to the minutes, was linked to the GSO drive, Don't Throw Me Away. But by 1997, in response to the area's needs, we sought the goal of to keep the record straight, to avoid substantial distortion so that myth did not predominate over fact. And that's, I believe, a pretty good quote, a clear quote from BLW. So we had one person to assure the safety of the collection over time, a place where area officers might go to research the records, and an officer and committee delegated to check points of fact when issues came up conducting business. It's not SOS. Do that? I thought maybe there was some kind of communication going on. During this same period, our committee endeavored to educate and interest the fellowship in the subject of archives. And to that, with that goal in mind, we drafted an archives play, which we acted out with great zeal, and to the entertainment, I'm not sure the education, but to the entertainment of those who watched. We also worked on presentations at the different area events. And creating displays. We sought to drive home the need to collect records at their point of origin. And delegating an archivist for the groups and districts. So things were not, we could assure that things were not going to get lost. We realized at that point that... You mean it's like the vibration, or? Oh, that's it? I didn't realize that would happen. Okay, wow. Well, turn your phones off. Next time I won't be so sweet about it. Okay, so it really was a process of cajoling the area into being responsive to the needs of the Archives Committee. We felt like we were the redheaded stepchild, and indeed we were. We sought to drive home the need to collect records, and one of our success stories is a district event where they have annually old or long-timers speaking, and they take those long-timers. And they've been very successful in getting attendance to this meeting and setting a precedent. We still have a few holdouts who feel like archives is not important in carrying the message. In all respects, the need to remember what it was like is apparently important to me, and I don't understand the blind spot that some people have in that regard. On an area level, the same issues come up repeatedly over time, and we have benefited by reviewing the reasons decisions were made in the past. And I see this in the going over the minutes of the area assembly. Over decades, the same issues crop up and the same discussions. And it's very beneficial to be aware of what's happened in the past. Establishing the importance of archives has been a process, and for us cannot be considered a done deal. Our area is very fortunate to have a strong core of dedicated individuals, and I would say that our area committee, or our archives, is committee-driven. Some of this has been to counterbalance the criticism that we have a permanent archivist. So we want to be sure that there's not undue influence by one personality on what the goals are of the Archives Committee. And we don't want the committee to be negatively impacted by those who feel so strongly about the issue. Our effort is necessary in order for the information to be researchable. And right now, much of the focus for us has been to index and inventory our records. And we're doing this on a record by record. I told you. Don't make me come down there. I don't know where I am. But very okay. And this is some of us just have to challenge, don't we? I'm just kidding. our area is fortunate in having these dedicated people to work on the inventory. And I guess the character and flavor of each area's archives is different. We found that when we visited Perry in Arkansas, and he so graciously received us, and it was very exciting, that their whole history really is very different from ours, where ours has been more business-oriented and just been interested. We've been more goal-oriented in the assembly business. We learned some balance in the tools, coming to acquainted with the tools of preservation work. So that's where we're also applying our attention at this point, because a lot of our records are copies, but we do have some original documents that we need to ensure are not damaged because of incorrect handling. So that the trip to Arkansas was wonderful for that, and because he's just a very nice guy. I would also highly recommend the National AA Archives Workshop for anyone who has not attended. A couple of our members, myself and another member, attended the meeting, and we came back feeling so enthused. It wasn't only the information and the personal interaction, but the contacts we made, feeling like you're plugged into the system. So I really, to any budding archivist or any area, I would highly recommend it as an educational resource. You know what the heck? Right now, we're in a very exciting stage of our development. We are looking for a new repository. We have an ad hoc committee out there. It's exciting because this is something that involves our area directly. They're funding this effort. It means that we'll have more space. It means that we'll have our own space. It means that we can access our records. Part of the development of the Archives Committee is initially going from meetings once a quarter to meetings once a month plus the assembly for a couple of hours to having Saturday meetings which last most of the day once a month. And we just simply cannot get our work done without being able to access these records and work on them whenever it's possible. So that's very, very exciting development for us. We also have a rotating archives chair. That's a big plus. It means that another person has a position open to them to work in service. It means that the area is connected. We're not isolated. We're directly plugged in, if you will, to the needs of the area. It's more of a two-way communication. Plus, you've got the fresh energy and ideas. You've got the fresh input. So that's been a very big one, big change for us. And really, I don't know if there are any more notes, but am I running out of time? I have no clue. Oh, okay. Well, something I would like to share with you and that I came across was from the Markings, Volume 12, Number 1, 1992, and it's the 12 Steps for AA Archives. Now, this is new to me. I don't know if any of you have ever come across this before or remember having read it, but let me I'll make this short. Step 1, admitted that we are archivists, that we are archivists are powerless over the natural cycle of deterioration that all documents will go through. Step 2, came to believe and trust that the higher power who brought these precious AA materials to our care will restore them to a condition of usefulness. Step 3, having accepted our powerlessness and having come to believe that we cannot do all this work alone, we made a decision to turn our will and the life of our archives over to the care of little G-O-D, good orderly direction, as we understood it. 4, took an inventory of our collections, making it fearless and thorough. Step 5, admitted the exact nature of our archives' problems to a higher power, ourselves, very important, and to others on our archives committee or to someone else in AA archives work elsewhere. Step 6, became entirely ready to have good orderly direction, God, as we understood it, remove all the defects of our collections. Step 7, humbly asked for help to do the work that needs to be done. Step 8, made a list of all the items that have been harmed by the passage of time and the handling of many people and became willing to amend them the best we could. Step 9, made these amends whenever possible, except when amending will injure the documents themselves or other materials in a contact with the documents. Step 10, continue to take inventory of our archives collections and our actions as archivists. New materials will be added and new skills will soon to be learned. Some duplicates or inappropriate items will need to be discarded, as well as sloppy or ineffective techniques in our management of the archives. Step 11, prayer and meditation are as necessary to our work in the archives as they are to our daily sobriety. Without a conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves, we can easily lose our way when faced with the overwhelming challenges of our archives. Step 12, having had the spiritual awakening necessary to work these steps, which means putting our service activity on a spiritual plane, we then try to enthusiastically carry the message of hope and recovery that is expressed in our archives to other alcoholics and to practice the principles expressed in these steps in all our affairs.
That was Sarah D. And I want to mention to a lot of you people that might not be familiar with that the archives newsletter, Markings. It's a great little little newsletter that Michelle puts out over at the General Service Office. Michelle, would you stand up, please? Michelle is our archivist for the General Service Office. Thank you. And the latest newsletter that just came out, you can get a copy over at the GSO Archives booth. They have a fantastic little article. Actually, the whole paper is on their history or little excerpts on every international that we've had so far. And it's fantastic. It gives you all the attendance and stuff like that. And it's really informative. And you can get it online. Just go to AA.org and look into how you can get one. Okay? Thank you so much on that. And now I'm going to introduce a good friend of mine, Perry. I've seen Perry a couple of times, met with the gentleman, and he's from Arkansas.
Thank you, guys. I'm Perry. I am an alcoholic. I am privileged to represent the Area 4, Arkansas, as archivist. And my sobriety date, September 16th, 1997. My home group is the Cosmopolitan Group of Alcoholics Anonymous in Little Rock. And I'm not going to bore you with all the meeting times and dates. And we meet every day starting at 6:30 in the morning, usually one at noon, 5:30, 8 o'clock, 7 o'clock, 9 o'clock at night, weekends, midnight on Saturdays.
Tell us all that.
How much of my time? Anyway, and while it is fresh in my mind, and Sarah having mentioned the National Archives Workshop, this is a workshop where the archivists meet. Archivists from around the U.S. and Canada meet once a year, and discuss archive techniques, improvements, copyright issues, conservation and preservation issues. This year's workshop will be in Macon, Georgia, and September 22nd weekend, I believe it is. And there is a website, and I'm going to ask.
We're not supposed to make any announcements or something like that, I don't think.
Okay. Well, anyway, the workshop is there, and you can access it through the web at web address. This is where I got most of my intensive training, really. I'm privileged to have worked with one of the founders of this workshop in conservation areas as well as archive. And the conservation stuff they'll deal with tomorrow. Our archives actually got underway in the early 80s intensively. Up until that point, I understand that one of the members in the area had basically driven around with a couple of boxes of old records in the trunk of her car. And at some points, and there was some efforts to try to preserve some of these records. And she asked for help from the area and different districts. The people who I worked with most intensively kind of like started going around the state in mid-80s and just interviewing old-timers and collecting old materials from anybody that they could get, business meeting minutes, financial records of the meetings in the different districts. We're a 12-district area, and which covers the state. And each one of those districts has set up an archives committee with a chair in each district. The archives committee meet quarterly at the area assembly and where they discuss stuff. At present, we have updated to the point that now we have a website where we ask our districts to send districts, our groups, everyone, anyone with any business meeting minutes, anything, to send to a central website so that we can download it and serve it that way. Since 1940, when Arkansas, when AA came to Arkansas, and it is mentioned in AA Comes of Age, I think on like page 24, 26, where Bill Wilson talks about that mail order group in Little Rock. It's also mentioned in the Jack Alexander article in Saturday Evening Post, that mail order group. And how it got to Arkansas is that one of our founders read an article in Liberty Magazine dated in the spring of 1940, I believe, and wrote for a copy of the book. So there, already we have bits of archival information just from that little bit. And the reason we know this is because we have copies of the letters that were written to New York to get the book sent to Arkansas. We have minutes of the or notes from the minutes that were taken about these meetings. Fortunately for us, there were people who were at those original meetings who were still alive when this effort was undertaken, when it first started trying to set up a repository. And that's what I kind of try to concentrate on, is the area of how to collect material, what materials to collect, who collects material. And that is one of the things that we have pulled together a real nice workshop and flyers that we do in our area and for our districts and our groups. And that Sarah made reference to the fact that we do a presentation there in our repository. We do have a permanent repository spot, which is funded by the area assembly. I've heard different areas having different means of funding. We are funded through our area assembly. We pay a nominal fee of rent to a foundation there in the city of Little Rock where our repository is housed. One of the things that I was told to stress is that we never purchase anything. It might be important to some of you to note that we have a complete collection of first edition big books, all 16 printings, and they were all donated from members of the fellowship. So there's no money changing hands to buy anything. None of this eBay business or you have to start it long before that. But we try to encourage people to go out into the community, into the AA community, talk to old timers, talk to the people that are there, that were there when it started. We've, through the GSO workbook, archives workbook, where there's a list of questions, suggested questions to ask old timers. You know, things that you might want to know to get a history. What is your home group? What was your home group when you first came in? And these things are important. One of the things that I start finding out in trying to do these interviews with old timers, and a lot of them will not talk. A lot of them won't tell you anything. They don't want to talk about that old history. I have a guy in my home group who's got sober in the early 50s. His son is sober now like 28 years. And I was asking the son one day about interviewing his father. And he said, well, he's not going to tell you anything. But if you want to get facts from him, just start talking about something and give him something you know to be half truth and watch him correct you. that's what it is. You can get those old guys to straighten you out in a hurry by telling them a little bit of a lie. Each one of our 12 districts have a committee chairperson. That committee chairperson, those 12 committee chairs make up the area archives committee. And we do invite participation on our committee from any member of the area assembly. We have developed a great little information pamphlet that we give out at all of the area assemblies as well as any group workshops or any conventions that we go to, which has information on how to contact us, what to do about collecting material, how to start collecting materials. And it's very informative. And it's basically modified from the GSO archives workbook. And I would recommend that anybody who has not started an archives collection, or even if you're in the middle of one, to look through that workbook. It's very interesting and informative, very small book, and don't take a lot to read it. Our committee meets, like I say, at the area level. We have a Saturday work day every other Saturday, whereas we meet at the repository and try to catch up with filing and chronologically getting stuff in order. We have records dating back from 1940, and we have basically in acid-free boxes and acid-free folders, which is another area that of archives work that gets more into conservation than archives. I personally am not a conservator. I've learned, picked up some techniques from working with the people who came before me. But my biggest job as archivist is not to preserve or not to conserve material. It's to collect, to file, and keep in as undistorted an order as possible the facts. If I run across when I'm collecting, then how do we collect material? We just go to the fellowship. Every area assembly, and even before that, I'm given material. Most of it, we're from Arkansas, so we get a lot of Walmart shoppers. Most of the stuff I get comes to me in big Walmart bags. Just papers stuffed in a bag. Some of it from GSO that hadn't been to a committee member that hadn't been opened yet. So, they don't know what it is. The markings come in a sealed envelope, so a lot of those. So we get a lot of duplicate material. And in the beginning, when our repository was first set up, those guys saved everything. And I say those guys. It was a married couple, Bob and Faye W., who were real instrumental in our workshops. and archives committees. They saved everything, and they filed it. They cleaned it. They put it away in very good condition. Well, one of the things that we found out in just real recently is that we're running out of space in the building that we have. How are we going to save all this stuff? And a lot of that stuff that was very important that we kept, hard copies, paper copies of then, wasn't available on the Internet or online, so they kept it. And now we can get some of that stuff. So we've come to a point where we have to decide, well, how important is this to the history of our area that we have a copy of something that with a few clicks of a mouse I can get from New York and print out as many copies as I need? So one of the things you want to be aware of is how fast is your collection growing? How much storage space do you have? How fast is it expanding to overrun your space? And that's one of the things that we're doing. But even with that in mind, we encourage everyone to send in anything. You don't have to worry about deciding what condition it is it's in, whether we have 20 copies of it or not. If you think it's of interest or if you find it, send it in. We'll go through it and decide whether it's something that's historically significant to our area, if it's something that we have more than one copy of, we offer it back to you to use in your groups or whatever. One of the things that we try to include in our archives collection are not just the area and the group and districts, but also our Southwest region where we're located. You know, materials from there we keep. And if there's any question about any of it, save it anyway. And one of the things that we try to encourage people to do, one of the big things, is don't try to store this stuff at home. If your house is anything like mine, you get overrun in a hurry with a lot of boxes of paper sitting around. Bring them to me. I'll get through them and give you back what I don't find useful or destroy it for you if you want. And one of the things, like I say, one of the biggest things is we're continuing to sort. If your archives isn't always in some sort of disarray, then you aren't really working hard enough. You know, it's a job that's never, ever. If you set out to do it, I'm going to do this and complete this job, you're setting yourself up for a big resentment. As those guys, I mean, you know, you've always, and I used to try to do it, whenever we were going to do a workshop or a presentation, have guests come in, or try to clean the place up and make it all spotless and pristine. And Faye W. finally pointed out, she says, Perry, if you do that, people will think you aren't doing anything. You should still let them see that it is a work in progress so that they don't get overwhelmed by it. And when I get to the point that once I've collected all this material and have it in the repository, have it in the rooms there, then I got to figure out what to do with it, how to sort it and file it. And it was easy in the beginning because, everything came out of New York. There was no Southwest region. There were no 12 districts in the area. And I just put it in boxes like that. But after a little while, it started getting overwhelming. So what I did was just went by and got just old boxes and labeled them New York area districts. And as I opened the Walmart bags of stuff, found out where they originated and put it in that box. You know, right now that's just a rough sorting. We're just going to sort it out, figure out where it came from. And again, you know, once you get it broken down to that point, then start looking through it to see what the historic importance is in your area. See if it does have any importance at all in your area. One of the things that we do at the Archive National Workshop is you find that people bring stuff from all different areas that they know don't pertain to their area of history, and they're running out of space, so they're trying to get rid of it. And they have a table set up for just bringing leftover stuff, or stuff that's out of area, we call it. And you can, you know, if you're from one area, then see some of your material there, and then you just collect it, take it back, and go through that same process of deciding how important it is to you, whether you have more of it than you need. one of the, then we talk about cleaning materials, and again, that's getting into conservation, so I'm going to leave that to the guys tomorrow. We have developed a travel display, what we call just materials of historic importance. I said we had a copy of every printing of the first edition of the Big Book. That when we're going out within the state, we'll set up a travel display to just take out to district conventions in the state. And where we do, how do we fund that? The Archives Committee does not fund it. We have the district who is presenting that convention fund it. You know, if they're willing to pay to have it come, meet certain criteria like have a secure place to keep the material and basically someone to manage and sit with it all the time, then, you know, they pay for those expenses, we'll bring it to them. And one of the committee members are usually with it all the time to kind of help explain what stuff is, answer questions, get to it. And one of the biggest things, again, back to the area of interviews, is doing histories of people. And I hear all the time, well, I don't have a recorder. A pencil and paper works just fine. You know, you get a couple of old guys in a room together and just listen to what they're talking about and ask them a question about it. You know, just kind of like asking questions about why or why they had that argument, why they do things a certain way. And then look at how many different opinions we have on that. And it's easy to kind of straighten out some of that stuff. You can go back to the records of the business meeting minutes and see. So that's one of the biggest importance, keeping it as undistorted a manner as possible for the future of those to come. I had a couple of other things I wanted. And what things to do, use for taping, like when I first started, it was just the old cassette tapes. But we have vinyl records that I need to get to New York. We have cassette tapes. We have 8-track tapes. We're now up to using digital voice recorders and storing stuff on compact disc. Even with the storage of these things on the disc, we're still managing having to keep a hard copy, printed copy of it because we don't know for sure how long that disc is going to last. And we know that the paper will pretty much survive anything but a fire. The more expensive items we have, the more what would be monetarily valuable things, such as the collection of Big Books are kept in a fireproof safe in the repository, stuff that's the most historically significant, like the letter that was written to New York requesting a copy of the Big Book is in that safe. You know, those things are kept locked up. We are always there to, you know, the biggest thing is take out the workshops around for the different groups, and we're willing to do it at any level because you don't know what bit of history is going to come up. And we try to talk about old-timers as being 20-plus years. I interviewed, recorded a 27-year anniversary at a group that the oldest member of one of the original members of the group was only sober like 16 years, even though the group had been there 17 years. And there were people in the group who had more sobriety than he, but they had moved into the area. You know, so he was the guy that we were most interested in getting the history of. Now, it doesn't do any good for me in Area 4 to have a 60-year history from somebody in Kansas City. And I want the oldest person in this district. I want the person with the best memories in this district. And the only way you're going to preserve those memories is to start getting them now. You know, people, one of the groups, districts in the area is having a old-timers panel. And we're going to go be there to record that and to talk to the old members. Through those things, you get addresses of people. You get names and dates and stuff that you can look back through and find out. And I encourage you to keep everything you get your hands on right now. Then, as your space becomes more limited, then start narrowing it down to just the stuff that's generated in your area. But don't be afraid to start. You know, don't worry about a lot of expense in doing this and keeping this stuff. You know, we try to encourage you at some level to get to the point of conservation and which would involve the expense of acid-free boxes, papers, archival materials. But don't let the fact that you don't have these things or don't have the money for archival materials stop you from starting your collection now. I'm not going to get into that little part, but one of the biggest encouragements is try to just ask questions. Ask the old people to just sit down and talk with you. Start recording, start filing, sorting, and don't try to do it by yourself. That was one of the problems I had in the beginning. I was just trying to get everything done. And I found out, well, I can't do it. I had a whole bunch of stuff half done. So when I started getting the different districts involved in a work day and setting up committees to do certain things, then we're getting along pretty good right now. Yeah. If we can be of any service to anyone in any area, you can contact us. We are listed in the directories, and those are very invaluable, a tool for finding people and finding out when groups start. And we'll try to see any way we can to answer any questions that you might have. And I thank you guys for the opportunity to allow me to serve.
That was great, Perry. You know, it makes me feel good because, like I said, I'm the archivist for Area 93, and I'm not the only one that has to go through some of those pains, you know? You know, I want to mention one little thing that I had the opportunity a couple of years ago to sit down and talk with our past archivist, Amy, from the General Service Office. And she's a non-alcoholic, and she's one of those archivists that's been the archivist for universities or in institutions and other major corporations. And she said, George, you know, being the archivist for Alcoholics Anonymous amazes me because it seems to be the only corporation that their survival depends on remembering where we came from. And every time I feel like I think that's, you know, it's really commendable. And every time I feel like I might get overwhelmed with all the stuff that has to be done, and then I learned that I do not have to do it by myself, although that's my nature, thinking I could do it by myself, I remember that it's Alcoholics Anonymous, our survival depends on remembering where we came from, just like our sobriety. And it is very, very important, and it's such an honor and a privilege, especially for a person like me, to be the custodian of our artifacts and the custodian of our history. It's a great, great position for those of you who don't know that much about archives. Maybe you might want to get interested and see how you can give a hand. The next presenter I'm going to introduce is Iris from Canada.
Hi, everyone. My name is Iris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Iris.
And I'm very, very pleased to be here. Well, not really. I mean, I was really, really happy when I got the invitation, but as it gets closer and closer, you know, I go, huh, I don't know about this. But I wanted to thank Michelle M. from the GSO office and the convention committee for giving me the opportunity to share today. It's really an honor to share on any topic. I mean, it's a lot easier to talk about yourself, let me tell you. Now, when I'm talking about the archives, I got to have the facts. Anyway, I'm very, very pleased to be here to talk to you today. I'm probably going to talk a little bit it's a little bit different tack for me because I'm a person who likes stories, right? I like what we do in AA, and that is tell stories. And I always heard from Elizabeth, who's a real long-timer where I come from in the BC Yukon area. And for those of you who are geographically challenged, BC Yukon is the western, part of Canada, of course, the coast, and we're right above Seattle, and the Yukon is right beside Alaska. So that's where we're located. And the reason I mention that is because in my, you know, beginnings in the archives, I've realized how important it is, the context of position and place, time and place. You know, we have so much stuff in the archives, so we get it collected, and people turn it in, and there's no date, and there's no place. There's group records that we have no idea what the group's name is. We don't know where they were. We don't know when it was. So if you're collecting, if you're starting to collect, the one thing I wanted to say to you is please make a note of, you know, try and be a journalist, okay? Who, what, when, where, and why. And even if it's only the first name and last initial, we want to know you know, we want to give it that context, because without that, it becomes very meaningless in our archival sense. I also just want to say, well, thank you to San Antonio, too. This is a great town. And of course, the weather. I was going to say, you know, everybody's heard of a barometer. Barometer is that thing, the instrument, scientific instrument that's used to measure humidity, right, which we're familiar with in archives. But I wanted to mention I have one of my own. It's called a hairometer. The females here might know what that is. You know, the more humid it is, the larger your hair gets. Anyways, I just wanted to mention that. I'm using notes, too, because I can't remember all the stuff that there is to remember in archives. And I just wanted to say that it's been an amazing journey for me in the archives. Like, when I first, you know, like in our area, we have a number of elected positions, and then we have a number of appointed positions. And when you want to be in the archives, like I'm an archives chair, I'm not an archivist, I hire an archivist, or we get an archivist to work with us for our archives committee. But you can just put your name in with your service resume to get a position as an appointed, you know, as an appointed person. So, of course, I wanted a different position. And I got archives. And I went, gag me with a spoon, right? I got archives, right? Old, dusty, moldy, you know, who wants to do that, right? And that's, again, my closed-mindedness about what the archives are, right? It has turned out to be an amazing experience for me in terms of, you know, the growth of my own sobriety and in learning about the past, our past, you know, in the BC Yukon area. So when I'm going back to a little bit about telling stories. The interesting thing is that, you know, you go into the archives, and I'm sure Perry and Sarah and George have done this. You go in, and you're expecting to get some work done, and you start reading. And you read and you read and you read, and 2 hours later, you haven't done anything. But you know a lot more about the history of your little district or whatever, and it's fascinating. And it really goes to the heart. You know, it went to my heart for sure. So when I'm doing my talk today, I'm just going to talk a little bit about the stories. And is there anyone in the audience, I wanted to ask, is there anyone named Charlie here? No? Well, the three guys that are first associated with AA in the BC Yukon area are all named Charlie. And I just wanted to mention a little bit about that story. We have, from what I found in our repository, we've been in the current location for about 23 years. It's not a big one, you know, it's about, I don't know, 300 or 400, maybe 300 square feet. It's not very big. We have a lot of stuff in there, okay? And I do have to organize a group to just try and sort out some of the little, there's one little back room in there that really has to get sorted out. It's hard, you know, when you can't throw anything out. Or, you know, like you don't want to throw anything out, basically. So the first story I want to talk to you about is the guys who first got sober. 1941 was the first guy in the Victoria area on the island of B.C., okay? And he was all by himself, and he wrote to Ruth Hawk and asked Ruth and Bill for some information, and he got sent a red-covered big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he got sober. Now, I don't know that much more about that Charlie. That was Charlie number one. Charlie number two was in Vancouver, B.C., and the second Charlie was actually a non-alcoholic. His name was Charlie Welsh, actually, and his wife had died of alcoholism in the 1930s. And he had been in touch with AA, you know, like our Alcoholism Foundation, actually, the Alcoholic Foundation, because of his wife. But she, of course, didn't get to AA and died of alcoholism. And Charlie Welsh was a well-known businessman in Vancouver at the time. He ran a candy factory, actually, and he became known as the Candy Man. And he basically bankrolled the first AAs. You know how we have these wonderful friends, and they try and help us in AA. And in the beginning, just like Bill had friends who only gave him a little bit of money, mind you. So what happened was Charlie D. got 12-step by Charlie Welsh's brother-in-law from Sacramento, California, okay, way back in 1944. And this brother-in-law came up to Vancouver to 12-step Charlie D. because he was ready. He was, like, on Skid Row, had nothing, no, you know, estranged wife and kids, living on the bottle. And he was ready to be 12-step, and Charlie D. got sober. But he didn't have anybody to work with. So what they did was Charlie Welsh bankrolled them, and they put an ad in the paper, in the province, in B.C., right? Because it's 1944, before the traditions were written. So you could put ads in the paper, right? We could put an ad in the paper. And it was this great, I'll read it to you, actually, just paraphrasing. And the ad said, this is a positive and permanent release without cost, inconvenience, or obligation. It is a free service rendered in secret by alcoholics who have found freedom through Alcoholics Anonymous. Right, P.O. Box 464, Vancouver, right? So he got all these letters coming in. And this was one of the first things that I came across in the archives, okay? When I was working in the archives, I come across this little book with these letters all bound together in it, right? And it's these letters from Charlie Brown's first people that got in contact with him. And they're all dog-eared, and they're starting to fall apart, and I got to get help with this, right? I haven't gotten it. I started to copy them. They're not even copied yet. I have to copy them all. I have to copy. And then what they did at that time is the members were so dedicated and so service-oriented, they noted every letter that they got, right? He's got a note that says, I got this letter on November 23rd, 1944. I wrote back on November 24th, 1944. You know, they didn't waste any time. They dealt with every alcoholic that they got a letter from. A lot of them were from, you know, from mother, from the sister, from the son, because, you know, the alcoholics didn't want to write, of course. And he, you know, we got some from, obviously, there's some in there that are from the alcoholics. But it's just an amazing thing to see these handwritten letters, you know, the shaky handwriting, help. You know, and then Charlie making his notes and writing back saying, we'll send you a pamphlet. I will come and visit you personally. We'll make an appointment, right? And on it went. So, so Charlie B. and Charles Welsh and the first Charlie in Victoria were all there. And then the ad, actually, the ad got these first four members, and they were Gordon J., who was a salesman, Everett G., who was a soldier, and Fred H., who was an optometrist. And these guys were actually the first four guys that met west of Winnipeg in 1944. And they started meeting at Charlie Welsh's home. Again, Charlie, he had the nice house. He had room. And so he would put up the meeting, and these guys would had started to meet. And you know, it was just an amazing thing. They met for, I think, 6 months in Charlie Welsh's house, the non-alcoholic, right? And then they started getting so many members that they had to split, and they started forming new chapters. But funny thing was, though, in those days too, Charlie B was just was a fire engine as far as, you know, getting new members and 12-stepping them, and they call him the long 12-stepper or whatever. I think he just wouldn't go away, actually, once he got to their house. And so you know, they started getting sober members, and what happened was, again, they did, in 1946, there was this plaque that I found in the archives in the back there, and it's a dedication and an award to Charlie Brown, and it says, this is a commemoration for Charlie Brown, who did so much dedicated and self-service in Alcoholics. And they made him the first president, okay, of Alcoholics Anonymous, the first chapter in the BC Yukon area. Okay, that was 1946. Again, the traditions hadn't been brought down. The traditions were brought to the first conference in 1950 by Bill, and that was the transition. And when AA came of age in 1950, the 12 traditions were presented, and AA was turned over to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing I also found in the archives recently, and this is, again, this is, here, I'm going all over the place here, but I made a scrapbook for this conference, right? I mean, I found this other old scrapbook that was put together by another long-timer named George. It was somebody named George, finally. And he had this huge scrapbook of old newspaper articles that goes back to the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I compiled a little scrapbook in dedication of this 75th anniversary. And all these articles were printed in papers in the BC Yukon area, and magazine articles, and so on and so forth. And I brought that here. So I was very excited to find new things, of course, in this thing that hadn't been copied before. So we're getting these new things, and we have to copy them and get them out to the community, like Perry talked about, taking things on the road. We pack archives kits all the time, and we put things in them, and we send them out, and we do hundreds of what you call service commitments at roundups and so on and so forth, where we take the archives out. And there's certain things, obviously, that can't go out, which is original material, some original materials, and those letters that are so delicate, I can't send them out into the community, obviously, so we have to get all those things copied and put in books so that our membership can see these things and realize how amazing the service, the dedication and the level of service that people had back in the beginning in Alcoholics Anonymous, and how much that has affected the growth of Alcoholics Anonymous today. So I'm very grateful for the three Charlies, right, and for Gordon and for Everett. And I also wanted to mention this other point here, which I've lost. Here, just a second here, I'll find it. Oh, yeah, here's one. Everett Gray was the secretary, right? He was one of the brand new guys in 1944. And he wrote a letter to a member in 1945. Everett was a soldier, right? So he's extremely meticulous and he was an excellent writer. And he wrote this letter kicking this guy out of AA. 1945, and this guy's name was Charlie. They called him Chaz, right? Dear Chaz, here is it. I'm just going to paraphrase the letter, right? Because he's going, in view of your recent conduct, it is my painful duty to inform you, your name has been stricken from the roster. It says, you may reapply in writing at a later time. Okay. This is, you know, this is again before the traditions were written, right? And this is what was going on. This was what Bill was talking about when he said, send me your rules, right? And before the traditions were written, we had so many rules, none of us would have gotten in, right? Especially, you can imagine some poor guy who just wasn't doing the steps properly. I mean, we all would have been kicked out, right? So the other couple of things I wanted to mention, too, was that we have a couple of publications that were done, you know, like in the area that were actually printed, they were put together and printed in our area. One was called The Bottle Book, and this was actually these stories that I just talked about, the Charlie stories, they're all in The Bottle Book, and they are the beginning of the history of British Columbia, AA coming to British Columbia. And then they also talk about the bottle. And the bottle, this is another story, okay? And I'll tell you just a little bit about the bottle. The bottle was bought by Fred H., and he was one of the first four, right, Fred H., and his son bought this bottle of brandy in 1946, and he bought it because in those days, of course, they didn't have detox, so members were weaned off alcohol sometimes. So Fred H.'s son bought this bottle of brandy for him to use to help other alcoholics get off booze. And what they decided to do, though, with the bottle was Fred H. decided, and he was a sober member. He'd gotten sober. They decided to pass the bottle from one alcoholic to another. And they would give it to an alcoholic who was active in AA and who could carry it for a year without opening it. Okay? Big test. Okay? I guess if you carried it for a year without opening it, you were sober. And the bottle was passed from 1954 until 1982 when it was presented to the BC Yukon Archives. Okay? We still have the bottle. And it's got 3 ounces of liquor left in it. And they say it was never opened. Okay, so we don't know about that. But so it was, you know, we have these amazing, amazing artifacts. All of us do in all our areas, in amazing stories. And like Perry and Sarah talked about, I mean, that's what we want to do. We want to collect these amazing stories. Right? That's how we communicate with each other. Like I was saying, Elizabeth talked about, you know, some people say, oh, I don't want to hear about those drunk logs. Well, I like hearing about the drunk logs. I like hearing your stories. I connect you through my heart as an alcoholic by hearing your story. And so we want to hear stories from the past. We want to hear stories now, and we want to hear stories in the future. And we want to collect them all, and we want to keep them in our archives. Right? So I have one more little tidbit that I'm going to share with you. And this was... like, we've been trying to do a few things in our area, too. And I started out with a grandiose plan, of course, as you mentioned, Perry and George. That we're going to collect all the old-timer stories, and we're going to write a book. And, well, somebody in the past has it. Well, they've written 2 books, of course, you know, so you think you have to raise the bar or something. I don't know. Anyway, we are collecting stories of old-timers. And that's sort of... a large part of what our purpose is, right, is collect the long-timer stories and keep the record authentic. And Bill talked about that, too. We don't want just records of dates and times and places. We want those idiosyncratic stories, those magical stories of alcoholics in recovery. That's what we want to keep the record straight. But this one story, in interviewing one alcoholic we were interviewing three guys one day, and I interviewed a guy named Jack F., who is a past delegate and trustee in the BC Yukon area, right? And Jack F. had this story, he told me. And basically, he had a friend, and this is relevant to this particular area, San Antonio, Texas, actually. It's very relevant to this area. He had a friend back in the late 60s and 70s who was a pilot, okay? And he got to, he was a friend of Jack's, and he was requested to go down to the Air Force base and train fighter pilots for the Vietnam War. Okay, and he was trying to get sober. This guy was trying to get sober. And so he's down, I think, at the Air Force base near here, training fighter pilots for the Vietnam War. And then I think Jack said to me that he had to go. He eventually had to go to Vietnam, and he was flying planes in Vietnam, fighters, jets. What their meeting did was they recorded 10 of their meetings. Like, they decided to help this guy. We'll record our meetings on these, they were real, not real to real, but the next ones. Cassettes. CDs now, right? In those days, it was cassettes. So we had 10 meetings on cassettes, and they ended up taking this bag of meetings to, Vietnam. And he said, they're out there in the boonies. And he wrote Jack this story about they started getting fired on with Russian rockets. The Viet Cong started firing on them. And they had to evacuate this area. And he said the only thing he could grab of any material value was his bag of tapes, his bag of meetings, right? And everything was blown up, he said. And he said he still had his meetings. And that guy stayed sober, and two other guys got sober on those meeting tapes. And we have those meeting tapes, the ones that went to Vietnam and back. And we've recorded them and put them on to compact disc, and we have them in our archives. So that story just breaks me up. But this is what the story of archives is about, right? It's not about, like what I thought in the beginning, it's like dusty, moldy, dirty, archives. It's beautiful, beautiful stories. And if you're interested in improving your sobriety and going to the next level in seeking your higher power, I would suggest that you go this route, because you're going to find something very special and something to leave with for generations to come. So thank you very much for my sobriety.
That was great. I think one thing that you'll find in common with all of us archivists, there's a passion that we pick up, and you can hear it in the voices of all these archivists. You know, it's fantastic. You're going through things and you find things, like you were talking about the newspaper clippings. You know, in our archives room, I was going through this gentleman's stuff who just passed away. That's usually the best box, because you never know what you're going to find in there. You know, and I found return checks of a $15 donation that he made to Bill Wilson's memorial service after he passed away. And I'm going through some papers in the same box. And I found a newspaper, the Los Angeles Times. And there it is on the bottom. It's a big picture of Bill Wilson with his obituary and all of his achievements in Alcoholics Anonymous. And right above him, there's a big picture of Charles Manson in handcuffs. Both on the front page. I mean, it's just, those little things, it's like, I found this, and that's the biggest joy of an archivist gets is like, I found this, little tidbits. Iris was talking about in her early days in her area, there's three or four Charlies. In ours, there were a couple of Al M's. And, you have to use their last name because they're all Al M. You know? And there's a great little story where this one Al M was our third delegate until it was like 1956. And a couple of years after that, he wanted his sponsee to be a delegate. So on the way to the area assembly for the elections, this guy Al came up with this idea, and you can only find this in the archives, in little tidbits here and there. But what I found out was this guy stopped by one of the local sober living houses, a place called Chandler Lodge, where they held 30 meetings at this sober living house. So he goes, well, wait a minute, I got an idea. He runs in, he grabs 30 guys because this meeting place has this sober living house has 30 meetings. So he figures he's going to pick up 30 GSRs, go to the assembly, get them all registered as GSRs, and pay the vote, And you really have to, and this guy is a character. So he does that, goes to the area assembly, they have their elections, and sure enough, his guy lost because it went to the hat. You know? You just have to love it, you know? There's another little letter that I found in there, and these are things that you just don't put out there in public. A lot of times we put out displays, but we can't use last names, and we have to be careful what we put out there. But we have repositories. I like to use the word archives display room / AA research library. You know, there's always some wise guy, when you say repository, there's always some wise guy in the back that's got some comment about it, you know. But we have an AA research library in Area 93 in Central California, and it's open to the AA public. And that's the whole thing. We have we have this stuff open, and we save this stuff for all our membership. You know, there is a big difference between archivists and conservators and preservationists and collectors, you know, but God bless the collectors. I see a collector here, and if it wasn't for them, a lot of this stuff would just be thrown away. People would just think they wouldn't have a value of this and that. And God bless those collectors that we have that open it up and display it for the AA public. You know, there are a lot of people that collect stuff and they just keep it in their own little library at home and it never gets to be seen. But we need to share this stuff. And that's what the archives is all about. And we learn how to do this stuff, even in our archives workbook, by getting in touch with the American Archive Society. We learn a lot from them. And one of the recommended ways was we heard a few people talk about the National AA Archives Workshop. I was honored last year. I was the chairman of the National AA Archives Workshop in Woodland Hills. And it's just fantastic. You know, they talk about this is the archives, a collective vision. I thought that was like the topic we have to work out of, you know. And I'm the kind of alcoholic. We have a topic, and it's got to be more difficult than what it really seems, you know. So I want to work it to death. And, you know, but all of us archivists, we get together once a year. And I think all committees should do this in a way. And in our own little areas we do, whether it's the Pacific Regional AA Service Assemblies or whatever. But we get together to train each other. Because archivists, it's most archivists like Michelle or Amy in the past, you have to give college degrees to be an archivist. You know, because there's copyright laws involved, library science, preservation stuff, there's almost some chemistry in there. I mean, there's a lot of things involved. But because of this National Archives Workshop that we attend, we're able to train each other about it. Last year I was fortunate enough, I figured, I'd call the Ronald Reagan Library and figure, look, can I speak to the head archivist? Well, who are you, you know? He got on the phone, who would have thought, you know? And I told him what our event was about, and he said, I'd be glad to go, you know? And he actually started laughing. Why is this guy laughing, you know? But the head archivist from Ronald Reagan Library came to our event and told us what they do. You know, and he actually went, and it was really, really interesting, he actually went through the different administrations of how they collect and where they save all of their records. You know, they start off from George Washington. I didn't know that Martha Washington burnt all of George's records. Little stuff like that, you know, we went through Reagan, and then when we got to, like, Nixon's administration, what they had to do with all this stuff, you know? But it was very interesting. It was really great. But, you know, it's the collective vision of all of us, because each one of us individually would run with it a different way. We need to get together, and it's the same with this program. We can't get sober on our own. We need each other to find out how do we do this deal. You know, Bill, if he would have started this program off, I believe, in his own direction, it would have just went out, burnt out really, really fast, possibly. You know, if it wasn't for Bob, to slow him down, pull him back in, it was the collective vision of the two of them that got us where we are right now. I'm going to plagiarize on what I heard Gail say earlier. You know, Bill and Bob had this vision, and then they went, and the 4th of July will be Bill D's anniversary. Well, when he walked out of the hospital, a free man, free of alcoholism. So there was Bill D. So the two became three. And because of the three, it became we. We're all here now. And it's a collective vision of all of our ideas. I want to bring up another little story. This gentleman, Eddie, and he started the first San Fernando Valley Convention. And it was one of those things where he went to the Southern California Convention, which is the big Southern California Convention. And I want to tell you a little history, which I found out only because of our papers in the archives. A lot of people never even heard of this, or even a long time is in our area. But when Bill came out into California in 1951, to explain his idea of the conference on how he's going to we get delegates and we go to this conference and how it's all going to work. And that was on a Friday. And then on a Saturday, he helped us with electing a delegate. So we had gotten a delegate, and that was a really, really interesting story. I don't even want to get into it, but that Al M. was involved with that also. You know, a gentleman named Chuck C., he was involved with it also. It's really good. But it was a two-day event. So Southern California, what they figured, because that was a two-day event, let's have a two-day event every year. So that started the first Southern California Convention. So that went on for years and years. Then there was a gentleman, he was the DCM for District 16 in our San Fernando Valley. And he said, you know what, San Fernando Valley we have a lot of members, let's start our own convention. So we started his own, he got together with the other DCMs to start the San Fernando Valley Convention. And he said, George, you're not going to believe this. And this guy, Eddie, he just took a 49-year cake 2 weeks ago. And he'll be speaking tomorrow morning. I'm going to have to go see his event. He's moved to Arizona. He says, George, it was the collective vision of a committee that I put together. I realized I can't do this by myself, starting this convention. So we put a committee together, and his idea was having a little brown paper bag lunch at this place called Devonshire Downs, which was just a small little fairgrounds. He put a committee together, and he said, and we asked for God's help. God got involved with this whole thing. And the very first San Fernando Valley Convention turned to be at the Universal Studios Hotel, a big hotel, and the first attendance was like 3,400 people. You know, and his first idea was a little brown paper bag lunch at a fairgrounds. And because it was, once again, that collective vision of the committee that he put together that pulled out what it is today. And I'm sure these conventions are the same way, you know. I want to thank my panel. It was fantastic. And I wish that everybody get involved with your history. Please go out there. Let's not lose the history of our meetings. I want to mention what got me involved with archives, or interested in the history. My wife and I went down to Florida and I walked into a central office. And on the wall was a big mural of a tree. So I looked at this tree. I said, what the heck is this thing doing here? So I looked at the bottom and it said, at the stump, it said Jacksonville. And it said Tampa. In Miami, and it turned out it was a family tree of Alcoholics Anonymous in Florida. I said, wow, that's an awesome idea. That's great. So I went back to the San Fernando Valley where I live. I went to the central office. Hey, has anybody collected the histories of the meetings in our districts here? And he says, you know, some people have started it, but then they dropped it. They went out of that, they rotated out of that commitment, and it never got pursued. There might be 390 meetings in the valley, and there were only 16 histories, histories of 16 meetings in the valley. I said, I'm going to take on that commitment, you know. And we go out there like gangbusters. We talked about that before. Here it is. I've been involved with archives for like 7 or 8 years now. I still haven't finished that project, you know. I'm still on it. I have gotten maybe 2/3 of our history. Some meetings don't want to get involved at all, and that's just going to be the fact. You know, and that's fine, but we do the best that we can. And but it's a passion that I had gotten, you know, and I worked up into just the San Fernando Valley, then I got involved with the General Service, and then I ended up being the archivist. And we are very fortunate. We have our own, in Area 93, we have our own archives display room /research library. And we have about 800 square foot. We're very fortunate, but we are starting to run out of room. A couple of weeks ago, a gentleman called up and said, you know, I had some speaker tapes, some cassette tapes I'd like to drop off at the repository. Great, fine, thank you so much. You just put them in the middle of the room. We go up there, and there are 8 filing cabinets full to the rim with speaker tapes. Almost 7,000 tapes. Speaker tapes from 1960, actually from the Long Beach International, you know, that was back in Long Beach, to 1999. And everything's nicely numbered and this and that. Please have the master catalog for this list, will you? You know, but, you know, we start to run out of room. And like we talked about before, we have to start learning what to keep and what not to keep. You know, should the archives be responsible for all of these tapes? You know, I believe if it's of a historical value, I would say yes. but it is a responsibility to still take care of all of these things. I want to mention there's another, some other articles that we found of early days. I found a letters, correspondence from this place called the North Hollywood Group in Los Angeles, one of the early groups that started in 1940. I found correspondent letters from a gentleman named Frank D. Matter of fact, his son Bob just walked in. That's why I want to mention this. But correspondence going back to 1940 with Bill. Fantastic, you know. And if it wasn't for people that before us that saved that stuff and and because of archivists before us that stopped cataloging and keeping this stuff, we're able to display that for everybody. It's an honor and a privilege to be of service in Alcoholics Anonymous this way. You know, I was, when I first came in this program, I was powerless over alcohol and my life became unnecessary. Yeah. I find that I'm doing stuff now for Alcoholics Anonymous that I never, ever wanted to do, you know. And I am really, really enjoying it, and it's an honor to be the custodian of our history. I want to close this meeting, and I want to thank all the participants. First of all, I want to remind everybody that you can get recordings of this meeting and any other meeting of the International at the, it's in Hall B in the Convention Center. The recording sound booth. So this is, all this stuff is available for you, and bring it home and put it in your archives. Yeah. So we all have a moment of silence for the alcoholic who still suffers. Let's close this with the serenity prayer, please.